Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with Philadelphia Orchestra Principal Harp Elizabeth Hainan and Principal Cello Hei Yi Nai. Both are soloists in upcoming concerts under Raphael Frubeck de Burgos. Susan Lewis takes us to the Golden Age, a new play by Terence McNally. The Philadelphia Theatre Company's production premiered last night. We speak with Gala True, a Veterans Administration medical anthropologist studying the use of storytelling techniques found in folklore and oral history projects to help heal Afghan and Iraq war veterans. And David Patrick Stearns profiles Prism Quartet. The all-saxophone group, celebrating its 25th anniversary this month, has built a repertoire of more than 120 pieces. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
In a series of concerts beginning Thursday, two of the Philadelphia Orchestra's principal musicians will be front and center stage as soloists. Principal Harp Elizabeth Hainan takes the lead in Joaquin Turina's Theme and Variations for Harp and Strings, while Principal Cello Hei Yi Nai is the soloist for Camille Saint-Saëns' Cello Concerto No. 1. I spoke with both women backstage at the Kimmel Center recently. First, Elizabeth Hainan. Turina had a definite Spanish influence on his work. He was Spanish. Is there anything of that to be heard in this piece?
Yes, which is wonderful because I love Spanish music, and it really has a great character on our instrument because we're able to pass off as a guitar at times with the way we play on the strings. So we have, you know, a very evocative quality for that type of music. And even though this is a short work, it's charming and it's beautifully written for the strings, and that it's like chamber music at times. So there's really some nice, interesting parts for my colleagues to play as well.
Something people might not appreciate, that as an orchestra player playing the harp, you're one of the few people who has to look at the conductor, look at the music, and look at the instrument, because all of the strings feel the same. So you're actually having to do three things with your eyes. How is the experience different when you're the soloist?
Well, first of all, let me say that's so insightful of you. Thank you so much for appreciating
that. Well, I can't think of anybody else who does it.
No, you're correct. Yeah, even the pianist, I mean, they can basically feel their way around. And that's one of the things I really drive home to my students, is that you have to practice that sight line from your fingers to that conductor, you know, putting some imaginary spot on the wall or a clock or something to visualize it. And so in orchestra, I would say it's more strict because of those facts. As a soloist, I feel quite liberated because normally I don't use music when I perform for solo. So that's really liberating because I just can watch my fingers and I can look up at the conductor occasionally. So it's easier in that respect than when I'm back in the orchestra chair.
Having to look at three things.
Yes.
You're only looking at two things in this
yes.
instance. How does your preparation for the role of soloist differ from what you would be doing on a normal day at the office, so to speak?
Well, it's different in that, I mean, you feel like you have a little added responsibility, obviously, because you are the soloist, and whereas in the orchestral literature, you're supposed to be blending and at times coming out, if it's so called for. But again, it goes back to the fact that I'm playing solo with the Philadelphia Orchestra, so I feel that I need to know it in my sleep, you know. So I need to really know it inside and out and all the inner workings, and I owe it to myself, I owe it to my colleagues. To really be prepared.
The Philadelphia Orchestra's principal harp, Elizabeth Hainan. She's the soloist for upcoming performances of Joaquin Turina's Theme and Variations for Harp and Strings. On the same program, to be conducted by Raphael Frubeck de Burgos, is Camille Saint-Saëns' Cello Concerto No. 1, with the orchestra's principal cello, Hei Yi Nai, as the soloist.
I first learned it when I was 11 years old. It has some tricky spots, like runs and stuff in the third movement. But it's also not considered the most difficult pieces, like Prokofiev or Dvorak.
It's unusual in that it's difficult to note where the movements are. It's almost one continual piece.
That's right.
How is that then to play? Because it's a very, very busy piece for the soloist. You're
right,
in there
right.
right from the start.
Right, that's right. I have no break. I have to just keep going until from beginning until the end, you know, make sure that I don't fall asleep in the middle.
So you mentioned the fact that you you learned this piece originally when you were 11 years of age, and I'm not going to clearly ask you what age you are now, but let's just say it's been more than 2 or 3 years that you've had this piece in your fingers. How much revision is involved in your preparation for this performance? Or is this a piece that's so familiar to you that you could wake up in the morning and play it by heart?
I know it very well, but I still have to keep practicing it, even though I've known it for a long time, because it's very dangerous to kind of sit back and relax and say, oh, I know it, I don't need to practice it, you know, and then 3 days before the concert, go, oh, no, I really should have practiced more on this run or that, you to place you. But I'm not under too much pressure.
Sansons has a reputation as being somebody who liked to tinker with formats, as is evident in this piece, that he hasn't followed the traditional concerto form. He's also a composer who is described as having a great wit. But there are little jokes in there. There are little nods to the audience. There are little things that he's doing to be, sometimes you think, just purposefully a little bit disruptive. Is there any of that going on in the cello concerto?
I think the way that he wrote the tricky run for the cellist, I think that's kind of that's kind of a joke. He's making it very difficult for us to play, because if I were just playing it, I think it's fun, you know, it's fine. But if I play from beginning of the piece and to that point, which is three quarter of the piece, then I feel, oh gosh, how come I can't do it anymore?
Because you're exhausted.
Because I'm tired. Yeah.
and then by the time you get to that place, though, you're warmed up at that point.
I'm warmed up, and you know, I'm ready to play it. You know, and whatever happens, it happens. You know, like a live performance, you just. Whatever goes out just goes out. You can't retrieve it back and say, oh, let me do it again or anything, you know.
The Philadelphia Orchestra's principal cello, Hei-Yi Nai. She's the soloist for performances of Camille Saint-Saëns' Cello Concerto No. 1 in a series of 3 concerts at the Kimmel Center on Thursday evening at 8, Friday afternoon at 2, and the following Tuesday, February 2nd at 8. The program, conducted by Rafael Frubeck de Burgos, also features Turina's Theme and Variations for Harp and Strings, featuring principal harp Elizabeth Hainan, Faye's Suite from El Amor Brujo, and Beethoven's Symphony No. 5.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Multiple Tony Award winner Terence McNally has penned dozens of plays and screenplays and written scripts and books for both musical theatre productions and opera. Texas-born and raised, McNally has lived in New York City since he was 17 and has also had a long relationship with Philadelphia. The Philadelphia Theatre Company has already staged 3 world premieres of his work. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis looks at McNally's newest world premiere in Philadelphia, his first historical play, Golden Age.
Terence McNally sets his new play in the year 1835, backstage at the Paris Opera Italienne. It's opening night of Vincenzo Bellini's opera, I Puritani, written for 4 of the greatest voices of the time. McNally likens the excitement then to the buzz around a contemporary blockbuster.
A new opera was the equivalent of Avatar today. It was the new event. Cities like Paris had 4 and 5 opera houses. So an event like a world premiere by Bellini and all these singers brought from Italy, the whole city would have been excited about it, even people who had no intention of going. This was the popular culture of the early 19th century, was opera.
2 earlier McNally works explored aspects of opera. The Lisbon Traviata, about opera fans, was produced in 1989. Masterclass, about celebrated soprano Maria Callas, in 1995. When the Kennedy Center proposed to do a trilogy of his plays, McNally decided to finally pick up a work he'd started and stopped 20 years ago, but had been thinking about ever since.
I was very interested in the relationship between the creator, the composer, and his interpreters, because the music is just notes on a page, and it's the singers who give them life. Also, it's a backstage story, the stress and strain of an opening night.
Because Golden Age takes place backstage, the music of the opera itself is heard only in the background, sometimes loud and sometimes almost inaudibly. Yet it runs from beginning to end and functions almost as a character itself. Director Austin Pendleton learned the music as part of his preparation and asked the cast to do the same.
I wanted to be aware of exactly where they are in the opera while every different scene in the play is going on.
Is that so that you know what the character has just sung.
Yeah, exactly. And where they are emotionally in the evening.
Because scenes are timed to take place when the singers are not on the opera stage, learning I Puritani was critical to learning Golden Age, says Rebecca Brookshire, who plays soprano Julia Grisi.
Because when I'm backstage, I'm constantly listening to the opera, and so when it gets too close to my character's cue to go on stage for the opera, I need to know that to be able to make my exit from our play and entrance into the opera.
In this context, with the drama of both glamour and the ordinary going on side by side, where time is short and where energy must be focused, the play unfolds, driven not so much by plot as by the collision of characters.
How we react to each other on a very simple basis when there's so much pressure, the pressure of a premiere. And at this time, these people were huge celebrities. So the pressure of that, what you do in that situation when you're just bantering with another person.
Added to the backstage mix is the character of Bellini, whom director Austin Pendleton says is so nervous he can't conduct or even stay in the front of the house. Instead, he decides to spend the entire opera backstage.
So he gets swept up in all the turbulence that's going on backstage and the way all the different performers relate to him under the pressure of having to deliver his opera.
As one example, Mark Kudisch, who plays baritone Antonio Tamburini, recounts the scene where he walks off the opera stage into the Golden Age scene and encounters Bellini, played by Jeffrey Carlson, who asks him how his aria went.
I say, well, you know me, I'm never really happy about how I've done. He points out that I sung a little flat. So I say, okay, well, great. If that's the case, we're being completely candid with each other. Let's talk about the cabaletta that I just sang, and it's not quite as good as you usually, if we're going to be honest with each other. And then we get into an argument on opening night. So neither of us has the most tact, but we're both also on edge because each one of us has something to put out there on an opening night.
The relationships between the composer as creator and the singers who interpret his new work parallel dynamics that McNally knows well.
A playwright is very much a collaborator and also at the mercy of his interpreter, especially a world premiere work. So one of the themes is this a great piece of music, or is it a great piece of music when you, Julia Grisi, sing it? You know, writer, finally, we write in two dimensions and actors work in three dimensions, and we need each other, but there is a rivalry.
If it's a new play, you try to be very protective of the text.
Director Austin Pendleton also has the perspective of being an actor and a playwright himself.
We're going to take this play as it is, and we're going to explore it fully. When a playwright is that good, everything is the way it is for a reason, and it's up to you to find that out.
Bringing a new work to the stage is an exploration for the playwright as well, suggests McNally. As the play travels from the creator's mind to paper, to directors and cast, onto a stage, and finally to an audience.
I'm finding out what this play is about as much as the actors and director are. And lights, sound, costumes, going to add a lot to it. And again, that's going to further reveal, peeling away the layers of onion skin to what is really at the core of the play. I have ideas what the play is about, but maybe I'm not quite right yet. And It's a journey we take together with the actors.
McNally continues to work on the play with its first director and actors like Golden Age's Rebecca Brookshire, who says it's exhilarating to help create those moments for the first time.
He listens to what our impulses are and might rewrite something or suggest different things because of what we're doing. And to work with one of the most prolific living American playwrights, it's kind of a dream.
The birthing process of Golden Age further informs the actors who play the singers giving life to the opera in the play, like Jeffrey Carlson, who says the lives of the characters are not so unlike their own.
They have the same insecurities, they have the same wonder, they have the same fears. And when you see in 2010 that cue light go off, you still panic and say, what do I have to give? And it's just yourself.
And while the show explores the tensions in creating a new performing arts production, director Austin Pendleton says its story transcends the world of opera.
It's all very human, just human behavior, under pressure, under stress, under the desire to excel, the desire to be noticed, the desire to leave a mark, which of course is a universal hunger. And the humor of that, and the heartbreak of it, and the comedy of it.
A play within a play, an opening of an opening, heartbreak and comedy, the stuff of life, says McNally. In this case, all wrapped up in the glittery world of a 19th century opera, from Terence McNally's imagination to ours.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Now in previews, Terence McNally's Golden Age opens Wednesday at the Philadelphia Theatre Company. The urge to tell and hear stories would appear to be hardwired into humans, no matter what the medium, from the earliest days of passing down tales told in gestures and speech to the use of contemporary communication technology. Stories are told to provide entertainment and information on stages and in courtrooms. In church confessionals and on the psychiatrist's couch, people tell stories to seek personal peace. Now the Veterans Administration Hospital in West Philadelphia is exploring the use of storytelling to help servicemen and women returning from deployments overseas. A project called the Life Story Study investigates the use of storytelling by veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan to improve their engagement with mental health services at the VA and to decrease social anxiety. The head of the study is Gala True, a medical anthropologist at the Center for Health Equity Research and Promotion at the Philadelphia VA. She has found that veterans returning from these wars have rich stories to tell.
The purpose of a life story approach is to basically help someone narrate their story as a whole, to really think about looking at traumatic events that happened during their deployments, but in the context of their whole military service. So not just focusing in on that one traumatic event, but looking at it as it fits in their whole experience in the military, and then helping them think about where they want their story to go next. So what do they see as a return to some kind of normalcy for them, or coming back to a whole life for them?
What's the history of this approach, and what's been its success, if it has been tried in other fields?
Well, a life story approach has been used mostly with Holocaust survivors. It's also been used with people who have survived childhood trauma and survivors of torture. I had done life story work with Hmong refugees from Southeast Asia who had experienced war trauma and lived in refugee camps. And the idea behind it is that by telling your story kind of as a whole, you're imposing order onto the chaos of what happened to you. It's never been done with veterans before. So one of the purposes of the study at the VA is to see, will veterans come and talk about their experiences? Are they willing to share their life story? And is it helpful to them as it has been in other populations?
And what's been the result so far?
It's been amazingly enthusiastic. In terms of what veterans themselves say, they find it to be very cathartic to tell their story. Most of them have said that this is the first time they've told their whole story in its entirety. They say that they usually don't feel comfortable talking about their experiences. It can be very hard for them to share their experiences even with their own family members. They worry about having their family members see them in a different light. So they did things while they were in combat that they understand happened in that context, so they were trying to survive. Or they feel that some of the things that they saw or experienced in combat, to tell a loved one or someone else, a civilian, about those experiences is really like putting a burden on that person.
But you're a civilian. How do they feel about burdening you?
Yeah, so they talk about that. They say that they tell their story, but sometimes they don't tell me all the details. And they'll say it's not necessary for them to go through all the details in order to have it feel cathartic to tell their story. They're not always interested in sharing all the details, but they're still able to reflect on what happened to them and what it means to them and how they're going to try to deal with it going forward.
And do you get distressed?
I do. I think that the hardest thing is probably hearing the stories of very young veterans who are 23, 24 years old, and the things they've experienced and the things they've seen. One of the things that touches me, especially as a human being, but as a mother, is sort of thinking about how are they going to get through this? And they're so young, and this is going to be with them the rest of their lives. But I'm able to sort of compartmentalize that and keep going. But also, you know, I know that in that moment I was there to listen to their story and to connect with them, and that they always tell me that they got something out of it, that it was helpful to them. So I think I feel okay because I don't feel like it's doing them harm. I feel like it's doing them good.
Long after veterans return from wars, the physical manifestations of battle have either gone away or they've been, the particular veterans in question have been able to deal with them. Clearly there's a need to try and help these people mentally as much as there is physically.
I think it's really important for veterans to understand that their mental health problems are something that they have to deal with sooner rather than later. And I think that there's been a lot more success recently with getting veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan to understand that. But I think that the sooner they get in for treatment, the sooner they get help, the more you're going to interrupt that cycle of mental health problems, and the less likely it's going to be that you're going to have people who are still processing these things 30, 40 years later, like you do with the Vietnam veterans. So one of the ideas around the Life Story Study is you get them before their story gets stuck. You know, you get them while the story is still fresh and while they can think about, what are the things that happened to me that I need to deal with? What are the ways I need to reframe some of my thinking? So there's a lot of stuff going on now around resilience training, getting people to stop thinking negatively and start reframing things in a more positive way to be more resilient.
Gala True, a medical anthropologist at the Center for Health Equity Research and Promotion at the Philadelphia VA. She, along with Robert Patrick, the director of the Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress, will be giving a multimedia presentation called Wounded Warriors and the Healing Power of Stories on Monday at noon. It takes place at Houston Hall at 3417 Spruce Street on the University of Pennsylvania campus. The event is free and open to the public. These are saxophones? They are when you're the enterprising Prism Quartet, a group that has commissioned over 125 works, with an ear for the unexplored possibilities of an instrument that many people are surprised to find outside of jazz and rock and roll. The quartet has long been one of the more specialized parts of Philadelphia concert life and is celebrating its 25th anniversary on Friday as part of Art After Five at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns caught up with Prism at rehearsals at the home of Matthew Levy, the last remaining original member of the quartet.
You didn't have to be a particularly eagle-eyed PBS watcher to see a familiar face in the widely broadcast season-opening concert of the Los Angeles Philharmonic under the celebrated young conductor Gustavo Dudamel. Saxophonist Tim McAllister, often seen with the Prism Quartet in smaller venues such as Trinity Center and Settlement Music School, had considerable screen time in the new John Adams orchestral work City Noir. That signifies an arrival of sorts. Classical composers don't often think to employ the saxophone. They aren't part of an orchestra's usual lineup, and McAllister had to be imported from Phoenix, Arizona. Prism's dream, though, is to have this much-in-demand American composer come to them in a piece specifically written for their four talents. McAllister and his colleagues are quietly militant about not letting any great composer slip away without writing a saxophone quartet.
We can't have people dying without getting a piece from them. You know, Leonard Bernstein died without getting a solo piece. Aaron Copland was supposed to write a saxophone piece. You know, we have certain kind of dream composers we'd like to have write for us. But
such as?
Well, I mean, we've talked about John Adams. We've talked about Steve Reich. Yeah, I mean, you know, some people like that. So, Tristan Murai at Columbia. You know, we at least want them to be aware of us.
Already, the group has commissioned new works from a huge variety of places. Composers who bridge the gap between classical and vernacular music, such as William Bolcom and Steve Mackey, as well as experimental talents who couldn't be further away from the saxophone's jazz heritage. One is Netherlands-based Jacob ter Veldhuis, better known as Jacob TV, who had the group performing with a pre-recorded tape of Baby Talk. The saxophone quartet is a medium with a spotty and not very well-known history, so without the weight of a distinguished classical music past bearing down upon them, composers seem to exercise a particular sense of freedom. And that keeps things, well, interesting, says Tamor Sullivan, a Prism member since 1994.
When you're involved in doing between 5 and 20 commissions a year, it's sort of like just tossing out the line, and you never quite know what you're going to get. And there are some that speak to us right away, and you know, we just crack open the score like, oh my gosh, this is going to be really an amazing piece. There are others that take a while for us to grow on us. One of our core pieces now by William Albright, which we think is one of the greats of the saxophone quartet repertoire, when the quartet got the first movement, was really a little bit stumped, as he'd say, like, well, you know, what is this? And the piece sort of had to teach us how to interpret it, and it took many years.
Many years, how many?
I'd say almost till, you know, probably a good 3 or 4 years to really grow into it in many ways. And now it's been, you know, 15 years later, and we can't stop performing it. And every time it sort of shows us something new about it, we see a different angle to it.
The title of this section, appropriately enough, is They Only Come Out at Night.
Those, in some ways, are the most rewarding. And then there are certainly pieces where we get them and they stump us at the beginning and they stump us at the end, and we do our best to give a great showing of them. But, you know, they might go on the shelf after that.
Some of the best pieces come from composers who walk into a commission knowing next to nothing about the possibilities of the instrument. Such was the case, says Sullivan, with Coloratura by Katya Agoc.
She was a student at Juilliard at the time, never written for saxophone before, and came over and was just asking all these very basic questions about, well, what does the saxophone sound like when it does this, and what if it does this, and then started asking other things like, well, if the saxophone were to sigh, what would it sound like, or these things. So we sort of gave her this whole lexicon of things the saxophone could do, and she returned this amazing piece that we've just recorded.
The biggest problem in creating a modern saxophone quartet repertoire is finding a place in the chamber music world already dominated by string quartets. As a result, saxophone quartet tends to be a graduate school kind of thing, particularly at places such as the University of Michigan with a strong tradition of sax pedagogy. Saxophone quartets are increasingly making a strong showing in important chamber music competitions amid a general awareness that some of the most exciting possibilities in the future may lie in new music for instruments not previously considered concerto-worthy. So all the years that Prism has spent presenting its own concert series in Philadelphia haven't been for nothing, but they haven't been easy. All the members have full-time jobs around the country, Arizona, North Carolina. Levy, for example, is director of the Philadelphia Music Project. Now, at his group's 25th anniversary, he's bent on releasing 3 to 5 CDs of new works every year as a crucial means of consciousness raising.
There are lots and lots of people who just haven't heard a saxophone quartet playing concert music, and for them it's really eye-opening to hear the possibilities, you know, this sort of endless range of colors and sound and incredibly beautiful music that is capable on these instruments. And so that's part of our mission, to really disseminate, you know, not only to commission new work, but to disseminate that work to as wide of a public. And that's really why that we're in this really intensive period of recording.
So often, you wouldn't believe what the group is doing until you actually hear it. One CD recorded in March is titled Antiphony, Music from China. Is everything possible here? So it seems. The music on the disc can be funny, menacing, eccentric, and always ear-opening. How strange that for so many years, the saxophone version of the Kronos Quartet has been right here under our noses, perhaps crowded out by so much else that's happening in Philadelphia. What makes Prism different from Kronos, though, is that Prism seems not to care about image, presentation, or looking cool. As a result, the Prism musical adventures go further afield, and maybe more consistently substantial.
Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. As part of Prism Quartet's 25th anniversary celebrations, the group performs at the Philadelphia Museum of Art on Friday. The concert is part of the museum's Art After 5 concert series. And that's it for now. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ribchester, and performed by Symphony and C under Rossin Milanoff. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.